depend on donors which could compromise the integrity of your system, the integrity of your information, the integrity of the whole cluster, the integrity of the state. So I was not just happy to hear, maybe I did not hear very well in terms of how you intend to solve this problem. Chairperson, those are my only questions. I hope they were short enough.
Begin answering those questions that were asked before lunch.
Thank you very much, excuse me, Chairperson and Honourable Member. Let me start with the last question and perhaps contextualize it in this way, as it became apparent in the previous discussions that arising from the questions that were raised by Honourable JJ, that there was a process. We did ask for money from Treasury, so donor funding would be the absolute last resort, but I'll speak to that as well. We applied for funding through the normal Treasury budget allocation, which as I had indicated in the presentation, we have received an allocation for IT infrastructure in the coming year going forward. So that is the one aspect. The exact figures in my mind, and we were just discussing with my colleagues during break, the exact figures I would rather not speak about until we've gone back and we've really ironed out the questions that the answers to this question in terms of the exactness. Insofar, and then in the presentation I also said, insofar as the business continuity plan, which we are very concerned about in terms of our effectiveness from a continuity point of view, Treasury has agreed to fund us, but that funding commences, I think, in 2012-2013. So this period, I think we are going to have to see ourselves within the existing baseline. This is what I said. Now, insofar as being grateful to donor funding community, we had a little bit of money left, I think, during the course of this year from, I think it was the European Union level of donors. They did agree, because we were worried about our hardware at that time, they did agree to support us in buying the hardware. We are buying them, they are not buying them for us. We are buying them, we source them locally, we are buying them, and we distributed those in court. So it is within that context. What we have not asked the donor community for is perhaps research and development and design of systems. No, we didn't ask for that, precisely because of the potential security risks that are associated with that. So that is the first question. The answer to the last question. Now, in terms of issues of servers, all our servers and hardware and all of that, we've clustered those under our broad ICT plan, which is a 3-5 year plan as well. And therefore, the funding we are going to, I don't want to use the word appropriate, allocate as and when we've looked at the implementation of each element or segment of that plan. With respect to the first question, it's a very challenging question to answer. Perhaps as a starting point, I must say the department has not done any study that shows that. So whatever information we may be giving will be anecdotal information, because we haven't done any research which tells us that this community is litigating vis-a-vis the other community. But what our observation, my observation, in particular, perhaps because this question has never even been posed to EXCO, so I can speak at a personal level rather than commit EXCO to the question, to the answer. My observation is that generally in the Constitutional Court, it's not your average person who litigates, unless they are supported either through an NGO but individual human beings, South Africans, don't generally go and litigate unless they are people who have resources and means. So it's those who have resources that have generally tended to access. Other people, for instance, if I use the Nyati case, it would have been through some legal support, either through the non-governmental organizations or some civil society formations that would have supported that. Superior Court, relating to the earlier question, again, an average person from my village, for instance, if I use my own community, Maud, I don't actually know of any person in Maud who would have litigated as far as the Supreme Court. I really don't know any, but again, it's anecdotal. It is clear to me, at least at a personal level, that where most litigation happens of the average South African would be in the magistrate's court, where, for instance, communities, the majority of the people of South Africa are, they litigate as far as the magistrate's court at best, at most perhaps slightly higher. And so that's, and it's an observation, it's not an informed, researched position. What I think the question is beginning to ask us though to do is to ask us whether it is an opportunity at this stage to perhaps ask this question again and perhaps commission some level of research that will give us an independent and objective answer to what is the makeup of the litigating community either way. And that we will think about with EXCO and we will probably give you feedback on. Thank you.
Chair, if I may pick up other questions that were raised. One was relating to the granting of a contract to the Bosasa security company. This is a question that also just is of concern to the department. When we approved the contract, we checked the process that was followed. It was the normal process of advertising the tender, establishing a bid evaluation committee that made recommendations to the bid adjudication committee. There were six service providers that were recommended. I think there were three options. And one of the options was to grant the contract to all six providers, and Bosasa was one of these. Because of the issues that have been raised by the media, we were concerned. We're even considering the issue of cancelling this contract. But there were a number of issues that we're faced with. One was that Bosasa has not been blacklisted due to issues of fraud and issues of corruption and so on. And none of his directors have been charged as far as we can see. But besides, we are aware that a number of departments have already either renewed their contract, I think Correctional Services has, but other departments have also granted them contracts. So it has been difficult to deal with them differently compared to all other people until they've been blacklisted and until they've been charged. So on that basis, I think we are proceeding with the contract. So I think that's the one question. The other question was on the issue of the TRC. We did say earlier on that we had 875 cases outstanding. We contacted Home Affairs to assist us with tracing people. They have assisted us, but they came back to us to say 500 of these people were deceased, and therefore we have to deal with the next of kin. And we have now, as I reported earlier, contacted the IEC to assist us. And IEC has come back to us and say they have positively identified 461 addresses, and they are able to link ID numbers of 579 people, as we earlier reported. And I think we have been interacting with the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation, and I think we'll continue engaging with them on a variety of matters. I think it's a good thing that they have proposals on batteries, because as we indicated earlier, the regulations on educational assistance, after approval by cabinet, they will be ready for public comments, And I hope that the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation will be one of the institutions that will be commenting on these regulations. Yeah, I think those are issues related to me. The issue of IDT chair, that was raised. I think the reason we have engaged IDT, naturally we would have engaged Department of Public Works. But we thought that IDT as an agency of public works much faster. And given the pressures we have, we thought that they were more appropriate to engage in this regard on community rehabilitation. Our Director General has already, with regard to the issue that was raised on the bill that is being tabled by the Minister of Defence, our Director General has already instructed that the regulations that we have, we must have an interaction with two clusters, social cluster and JCPS cluster, where defense is participating, just to check these issues of potential duplication that have been raised. And I think after those consultations, we will come back to the committee and report.
Thank you, Chairperson. There was a question in relation to the budget allocations for the Supreme Court of Appeal versus head of the Constitutional Court. The basic difference is essentially informed by the various services that are being offered by these courts. I mean, one area of funded under the Constitutional Court is a cost of the Judicial Service Commission. Under the Constitutional Court is also the Judicial Education Institute. All international travel of judges are being funded from the budget allocation from the Constitutional Court. I mean, there was a review, in fact, this morning, a review by the finance staff with the judges or president of the Supreme Court of Appeal in relation to their specific budget, and then raised the shortfall of an operational budget of 2.9 billion. So they've looked at what we've provided, and they've indicated they've got a shortfall of 2.9 million. In essence, this is being informed by the fact that there will be approximately 30 new judges, chambers, and they need to be furnished and person funding will be provided, but also the cost of the appointment of new judges and judge secretaries. In essence, the cost structure of the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court is different. The personnel establishment is different, and then also the services that they render is different, and that explains the difference in budget allocations. Thank you.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, thanks. This is just a follow-up on behalf of my colleague who asked the question. I still have to get to my question. But as far as I understand, she was querying the amount allocated specifically to the libraries, not just the whole budget. She was saying that only 100,000 was allocated to the libraries for the SEA, whereas it was 1.8 million for the Concord. That was the issue. And also just on the TRC question, I thought she was confused as to how you made up the amount, the numbers, because you said 875, then you said they found 500 were dead, so that only leaves 375, but now you found 461 addresses and 579 ID numbers. Is that maybe because of they are beneficiaries or the families? Is that maybe why? So they're actually more people than there were. Okay,
thank you. On the functioning of the libraries, there is a library committee consisting of men of judges who advise. I think Judge Dennis Davis is the chairperson of that committee. And there is concerns on the funding of the Supreme Court of Appeal. I myself went there personally and checked with the librarian. How is the budget being determined at court level? We've got over 500 courts. Now, the structure makes provision for a reasonable rate, a court manager, and the expectation is there should be engagement between these stakeholders, judiciary and the relevant court management, in when they allocate these budgets. At our national office level, we don't make specific allocations to specific courts for specific lower level line items. I think we are quite aware of the need, and I think in our budget presentations we've reflected a need for substantial investment in libraries and library services, But what we can do a review of the allocations and see what will be the impact of the appointment of the additional judges and then staff at the Supreme Court of Appeal, and maybe then do the additional allocations if there is such a need. Thank you.
Chair, just to add, one of the resolutions taken at the Judicial Services Commission was that these committees of judges that look at these issues work with us directly in the department, and we are doing that. And in fact, the virtual library is one of those, but there are many other committees that are looking at these issues, working with us, so that we can be guided when we do the budgeting to then channel funding appropriately. So perhaps just to conclude on the answer to the question, whether in fact we just sit and do the allocations without being informed by anything, no, there are processes. Have these processes worked actively before? Maybe they could have worked better to help us. Thank you. On the proposal that was made, we note the proposal. We would rather prefer that we engage with the proposal a little better instead of responding to it here. It's got a lot of interesting things that we would wish to look at, but certainly we are not in a position to respond to it. To the extent that there are some initiatives, for instance, the totality of the transformation of the judiciary, but of the judicial system, as well as the legal practice bill that we are working on, do begin to answer to some of these questions. But insofar as it being the proposal, I think to pick and choose elements of it that we are saying there are systems in place or will be systems in place, I think we will not do justice to the proposal. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. With reference to the question posed by Mr. Swartz, Honourable Swartz, regarding the State Liability Amendment Bill, he suggested that, or he asked the question, why does the department not budget for payment of claims against the state in general. I think it will be extremely difficult to do so, but you will recall, Chair, at the meeting that we had last week on the State Liability Amendment Bill, the view was sort of unanimously expressed that National Treasury should be more involved in the process. And this was specifically with reference to the judgment of Judge Mokgoro, or the order of Judge Mokgoro in the Yati judgment. Now, I met with the Accountant General, who also attended our meeting. I met with him last week, towards the end of last week, and I made a number of proposals to him on how National Treasury might get involved in this process, once again with reference to the order of Judge Mokgoro. They undertook to look at the matter. You will recall that he was sort of optimistic that there can be an involvement from the side of National Treasury. And they promised that they would get back to us towards the end of this week with recommendations, which we will then present to the committee when we meet again on the State Liability Bill.
You'll recall that in a follow-up I asked whether criteria are exercised for the appointment of private counsel. And if so, what are those criteria? You see, because at some point we may ask the question, so if every department is simply appointing private counsel, why do we need the office of the state attorney? And our fear is that that's the direction we're heading to. And what are the implications? Hence my question. DG?
Thank you very much, Chair. The answer is not going to be a straightforward one, and I'm not trying to be evasive in any manner. We've, as a department, together with our minister, have set to look at this issue on whether, in fact, there is a discretion by departments to pick and choose the council of their choice. We had a meeting of the senior state attorneys, for lack of a better definition, where this issue was discussed at length. And we are guided, therefore, by the State Attorneys Act, which places the responsibility and the duty to the state attorneys to defend government and then to source the council using the criteria that already exist within the state attorneys. What we had been beginning to experience was that every department had a council of its own choice because of the relationship, good relations that people begin to have with council that does help the facilitation of cases in one or the other. But something like that, in our view, at least as the Department of Justice, it's something that has to be managed very tightly and enable the state attorney, enable every department to procure services through the state attorney in terms of the choices of counsel. It does happen, Chair, when it happens, that under emergency circumstances, it may very well be that there are counsel that are not available, in which case, if a department were to raise and ask the council who's available, and upon proving that that council is available, that can then be pursued. So there isn't any other criteria that is specific, at least that we are aware of, and the work that I was talking about in terms of the engagement, even on council fees, were guided, amongst others, by this meeting that we held in September or so of last year. Thank you, Chair.
Unclear. We've got a state attorney. We do have state advocates, but they're prosecutors under the NPA. So any court work requiring advocates requires private sector advocates. Am I right? I mean, we don't have, the state does not employ unless it's sort of a departmental official. The problem, though, is not so much then the advocate, the counsel. The problem is the attorneys. Okay? When are departments able to go use their own attorney? Because some do. I think where there's a conflict between departments, then they will use their own attorneys. But theoretically, everybody should be using the state attorney. And just explain what is the position with that. So I think it's not so much the issue of the use of counsel. It's the issue of the use of private attorneys. When you do have a state attorney who's meant to be dealing with all that attorney's work. But then linked to that, it came up last time, the issue of, we were told, if I can just find it in the document, we were told you've got here on slide 13, this is on following interventions implemented to curb the spiraling cost of litigation. And it was develop a policy framework for the efficient management of state litigation. Okay, that's what you've told us now. Then in the budget review process, you told us, you being the department, I'm trying to find the document, here it is. You told us, you've got a policy, it's just got to go to Cabinet. It was in October. What's happened? So if you look at our budget review document, briefing patterns, maybe it's a slightly different issue, but you said in the absence of a policy framework, so it's the same thing, you're talking about a policy framework, it's difficult to redress the matter of briefing patterns. A policy framework has been developed but requires approval from Cabinet. So that's October. You've developed the policy, you're just waiting for Cabinet approval. Now, you've still got to develop the policy, according to the slide. What's going on? And then I think linked to that while I'm on the floor on this issue, I've got other issues, but just because... Sorry? Okay. But it was just with the issue of you know, one of the issues we've raised before is the briefing patterns. And there are targets that are being set. But amongst advocates, there's unhappiness, that there's a feeling that there's not, you know, that it depends on whether you go and schmooze the state attorney as to whether you get a brief or not. You know, so your targets as far as previously disadvantaged will not necessarily be looking at developing black advocates, but it will be if you sort of give it all to one person, fine, then you've met your target. Whereas a policy of development. But I think it would be useful, Chair, for us to actually get some sense of who's getting the briefs, because there are complaints about that. And are they being fairly spread? Is there a criteria? There has to be a criteria, otherwise it becomes completely arbitrary as to who do you brief, and are you in that briefing developing people? Sorry if I'm talking. It was just you were talking about the state. You know, they can't come and tell us there is a policy. Yeah. And now there isn't, suddenly.
Thank you, Chair. I'm looking around and I'm looking for help. The blueprint on which deals with the litigation, right, and the allocation of work, we call it a blueprint policy, which will look not only just at how we manage litigation work, but it's how we manage the work relating specifically to the state. There is a draft policy in place. We worked on it during the course of last year. We worked on that briefing policy. Therefore, it remains a draft until it has been adopted. We are consulting on the policy in terms of the normal structures, and then once that has then been finalized, it will then be a policy statement that will guide how we deal with issues of litigation for the benefit of the state. The issue relating to briefing patterns is
policy. I mean, we have the statement from last year. There is a policy, it's got to go to Cabinet. Now we're told you've got to develop the policy. Which one is correct? You're now telling us that there is a policy, but it's not going to Cabinet, it's still got to be drafted.
It's in draft. That is what I'm saying.
When is it going to be approved? When is it going to go to Cabinet? Is it ready to go to Cabinet yet?
Chair, may I refer the question in terms of the exact dates, because I wouldn't have them as I sit here. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. what we've done with the blueprint is that we had to do a lot more research than was originally in the document that was ready around October. Since then, we've done the research and we had a meeting with our forum with whom we consult, and the task of the forum is to actually present this, to develop the document. We had one meeting with the forum in March and we are consolidating the document. We had further changes to make in terms of that last meeting that we had this month, and we should be presenting a final draft to the DG within the next 2 weeks.
Comment then. I mean, it's a thing of why can't you tell us? Okay. Do you think we forget what you tell us in the past, that we shred the documents or lose them? You know, So when you come and tell us, is this policy, it's going to cabinet, what you should then, and that's fine, that seems to be accurate as far as what the position was in October, but you should then, instead of saying that we'll be developing a policy framework, you should be coming to say, look, we did tell you in October that we had this policy, it was about to be approved by cabinet, but we then discovered we needed further consultation, and therefore it's been set back a bit. So I just have problems. I mean, DG, you're acting on you're not meant to personally know everything, so it's not aimed at you specifically, but it's the department and the officials that are making the contribution to the strategic plan or the input. Is please don't insult us by thinking that we have no memory.
Can I then deal with the last question, which talks to the briefing patterns? On the briefing patterns, Chair, our previous strategy was very specific. We were saying we are going to do a shift and 65% of briefs, both in value and in number, we are going to give them to the previously disadvantaged categories of attorneys and all counsel. We have been doing that. We've received some reports from the state attorney, and in fact the meeting that I alluded to earlier was beginning to interrogate whether in fact we are meeting this target of 65%. We are concerned in terms of the credibility of reports in this sense. The strategy was approved last year, but the matters that we were referring, that the state attorney has been reporting back on, are not only matters that commenced last year. They are long outstanding cases which are being concluded, and therefore when people say we have briefed X or we have briefed Y, it relates in the mean, not just to the year under consideration, and we've requested that reports be structured slightly differently so that they respond to the year, but also then deal with historic information on how have we been doing on historic information. So to the extent that we have not been able to give a crisp number, and we haven't been able to do that, it's primarily because of that. That is the one issue. The second issue that we are finding as a challenge, and maybe it just goes to how we had worded our indicator of last year, was the fact that we had set both in value and in number. Now, in value, becomes a challenge in the following sense. You only know about the total value of the actual payments that you make once the matter has been finalized. So what we were taking was the brief value rather than what we have paid out. So I think to do the matching, I think there is going to be time where the two link, where we can do the matching. So that is the value of the brief, this is what we paid at the end of the day. But separate reports are being collated through the Office of the Chief State, Chief Litigation Officer, and those are the reports that we are interacting with to try and ascertain whether in fact we are meeting that target. Indicative reports, and I'm going to say indicative reports in case I'm quoted again next year. Indicative reports are beginning to show us that in some areas, not in all regions and or provinces, in some areas we are making much significant progress. For instance, in Gauteng, at least this is what the reports are showing us. However, in other areas, because of the absolute absence of very limited number of PDI legal practitioners, we are not seeing that progress. And areas that were quoted specifically, Kimberley and Bloemfontein, were areas that were quoted very specifically, but there are other areas that have a similar challenge where you don't have a senior or a senior, junior, that could be briefed, in which case we don't impart counsel from Johannesburg and Gauteng in general to those regions, and that sends a different reverberations in terms of noise that comes from the system, because people feel that it would be necessary that you empower people now rather than import those people outside the province and or region. So those are but some of the challenges on that one. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. No, I'm a little bit worried then, DG, because when the committee, when the department came in October, the department was very specific about those targets, and in fact told us that you're being a bit vague, which may be more accurate now, that you're not sure how you're doing in terms of meeting the targets. Last time, and I'm reading from our report, the department came and told us no, 74% of the briefs went to black practitioners, and it was specifically 3,728. I'm worried now that figure's not that accurate. If you're saying you don't now, 5 months later you don't know. So just to highlight that as a problem, I'm now questioning the quality of this information we were given, or questioning how we can be given, the exact figure of briefs in October, and now there's a lack of clarity. But the point is, and it's one we keep making, and unfortunately the department doesn't seem to be responding, it's not just the numbers game, it's the development. So you could find one black advocate who you give all the briefs to, and hey, you've met your target. But have you developed the number of black counsel at that particular bar? No. And it's other aspects like, some council have sort of mentioned to me things like giving a junior some kind of say around if there's a need for a senior, which senior is going to be used, because that will make the senior, the silk, more inclined to develop the junior in the hopes that they will get more briefs. If the junior is going to, the black junior is going to have more say over which senior is briefed. Whereas if the state attorney brief as is normally the case, brief a silk and then say find a junior, that silk does not have to, it does not have to really concentrate on, they got the brief, they can pick the junior, okay, it'll maybe be a black advocate, but hey, they're not going to really spend much time trying to train them. So it's those kinds of policy issues that need attention, not just the numbers game. So just to highlight that, thanks, Chair and Ms. Schaefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Before I go on to my initial questions, I also would just like to follow up on that. I'm confused by your agreement with the statement by Honourable Jeffrey that you have to have advocates. I mean, when I left practice 10 years ago, attorneys had the right of admission to court. So why do you have to be advocates? Why can't you have state attorneys appearing in the High Court as well with right of admission? As far as I understand, it's quite possible. So there's no real need, as far as I can see, to have to go outside at all if you have sufficient people who are capable and experienced in the department. So that's just another one for you to think about. Then just onto my questions from the presentation. Just one issue I want to ask, particularly about the security costs. I mean, and I agree that you can't just say, well, we haven't got money, so we can't have security at courts. It's just not acceptable. But what engagement do you have with the people who are managing the security at the courts at the moment? As far as I understand, there are private companies sometimes doing the actual access of the courts, and obviously SAPS is also involved. What discussions have you had with those agencies? I've been into a court where they haven't even picked up any, they don't even check your bag, or it's just simple basic things like that where you can make a huge difference in your security without having to spend a lot of money. Now, I mean, is that being done? What about the other thing that also concerns me is your maintenance of courts. We'll sort of do it as we go along. I mean, you've seen what happened in the Pretoria court this year. I mean, that's been coming for how long? You've been warned and warned and warned and warned about it. Nothing's happened. Now you don't only lose the infrastructure, you lose all the dockets and everything else that goes with it. I mean, the cost of that is just so astronomical compared to the amount that you would have to do. I mean, have you got some kind of risk assessment strategy to look at what courts are the most problematic and risky for from that point of view, and to actually deal with those urgently. Sorry, I just found it. There's one other thing with maintenance issues. I'm very glad to see you at least trying to address it. But I mean, there's one very, very effective and efficient and cost-effective method of enforcing maintenance orders in the High Court, which no one in the maintenance department seems to even know about. And if you're going to do publicities and whatever, and you're educating people, and educate your maintenance officers and your prosecutors. I mean, if you have a High Court order, which many people do, many of them will come to maintenance courts to enforce High Court maintenance orders. And they sit there and come from month to month. You quite simply go and issue a writ of execution at the Registrar's Office in the High Court on one affidavit from the person entitled to maintenance, and you execute against the person's property. Now, that usually focuses people's minds very, very carefully and very, very clearly on paying their maintenance obligations. Now, if you can educate more people to exercise those very simple rights, you can then avoid them coming to the maintenance court. And I'm not sure, as far as I know, that doesn't actually apply in regional, and I'm not sure if it does or not. Mr. Rudman can maybe correct me. But if it doesn't apply in regional and magistrates' courts, regional courts now for divorce, if it does, then can you just tell us in terms of what, so we can also tell people who come to us with complaints, and also publicize that fact more so people can exercise those kind of rights, and then claim back their whole amount of money, attach the debtor's assets. I mean, you'll get them sorting their maintenance payments out much quicker, I think. Case backlog is also confusing me, quite frankly, because when I look at the figures, I mean, they've come down slightly, but it doesn't seem to me that they really are that effective. I mean, how many cases are we doing in the backlog courts? Are there actually, is there any management of how effective the backlog courts actually are? Because it doesn't seem to me that for the specific attention that they're actually getting, that they are making such good headway in combating those backlogs. And it doesn't seem like the numbers overall are really coming down. One issue you didn't deal with in the vacancies is the issues in management vacancies. I know that was also a concern last time, as well as the CFO's office. How many senior management vacancies do you still have? Your office accommodation, you keep on saying that you need more accommodation, but your budget on slide 33 does not indicate very much of an increase, I don't think, to deal with that. And the other issue that I also have a concern about, and the committee did raise in our budget review last year, was the issue of giving attention to increasing the number of sexual offences specialised courts, not decreasing them, given that they were clearly more effective than the Citizella Care Centres and other general courts. And your budget there also does not indicate very much of an increase at all, which gives me reason to be concerned about it, especially given government's stated priority to take into account the needs of vulnerable. One thing I want to know is the contractors who, I mean, we were told last year that there were construction projects that were not concluded because of poor performance and poor workmanship. What has been done about that? Are there provisions in your contracts for damages for non-compliance with the contract? And has that been implemented? Have those companies been identified and put on some kind of a blacklist that they won't be used again? And your guardian's fund was recently in the news for reasons which we prefer not to have seen them there for. What have you done specifically to combat the guardian's fund fraud? Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the problem with leaving me so late. I have lots more questions.
Please bear in mind, though, and I'm not doing this to intimidate you in any way, we still have a second presentation which deals with the actual budgetary numbers.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is a comment just before the second presentation, before the round off. I want to comment, Khoso, I heard you talking about the tracing agents insofar as the TRC matters are concerned. But I just want to briefly, Chair, talk about my experience with the TRC. I was serving in the Amnesty Committee of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Now what has happened is there are two incidents that I will briefly speak about. One incident was in Welkom, and then during the week before our Amnesty Committee had to go to Welkom, the tracers were saying we are unable to trace the relatives of the victims, so that hearing was about to be cancelled. And then what has happened in it, it was said a person who was riding a bicycle entered into a taxi rank and he rode over a bomb and it exploded. The person was killed. And then I said to the committee, the Amnesty Committee, but it's strange that no one knows about that incident which happened at the taxi rank. And then the second one was in a White River. In White River, what happened? We had gone out there from Cape Town to White River for a hearing. And then on the day of the hearing, they were saying, no one is pitching up concerning an incident of victims which were at the back of a parky that was traveling in a, you know, on the gravel road next to a mountain, and it exploded. Some people were killed. What I said in both incidents was that it is really strange that you are unable to trace the relatives of the victims. I said, have you thought about using the radio, the power of sound? With the Welkom one, I said, just phone ICASA, Independent Communications of South Africa, inquire what is the local community radio station there, and announce it over the radio. I'm telling you, before the end of the week, they said we've managed to locate the relatives of the victims. And the one which was very, I would say, proving that there is power of sound, it was the one at White River, because our committee went there in the morning, and then when no relatives pitched, I said the local radio station is Lubalabala, please use it. And then the chairperson were the judges. They were saying, oh, we fly back to Cape Town. I said, no, let us not fly back to Cape Town. We went back to our hotels. We said we adjourned until the following day. Chairperson, when we were at the hotel, the word came to say the relatives of the victims were physically at the radio station and said, we hear that the TRC is around here. They are looking for us. They can't find us. So the point I'm trying to make, I'm saying the person who is in charge of trying to trace the relatives of those victims, please use the radio to some extent. And in fact, if I can link with that person, I was once a person, a manager of a community radio station. I know how it works and the like. I would I was there. I was previously, before I was a member of parliament, a station manager. But people still phone me and say, we want to be DJs. Can you employ us? I said, no, I'm no longer there. But if I can live with that person, I still have some contacts with ICASA and also some of these SAP radio stations. I've got some people I know, the email addresses and the like. I'm telling you, within 6 months, you'll see something happening through the radio. Mm.
Thank you, Chairperson. I only have two questions. The one relates to the responsibility for the department to evaluate and investigate legislation establishing Chapter 9 institution. I don't know if the department has had opportunity to look at the what is called the CADA report, CADA Azmal report, which looked at the need for this Chapter 9 institution to be rearranged. Because there are certain recommendations that they are making. Of course, they are making them to Parliament, but since it's your responsibility to give them the requisite support, I'd like your comment on that. But specifically, Chairperson, there's the Gender Commission on Gender Equality. that commission is operating in terms of an illegal piece of legislation, because it is a piece of legislation that is based on the interim constitution. It is out of sync with the provisions of the current constitution. And the gender commission has been talking to us while it was reporting to this portfolio committee, but now to the other portfolio committees, about the failure by this department to come up with relevant legislation to be considered by Parliament. I would like to know why has that been the case. The second question, Chairperson, is there's a bill that is before us, the traditional cost bill, which should have been passed a long time ago. It is still being considered by Parliament. And it should, the department, I would imagine, should be looking forward to implementing it. Now, my question would be, what plans do you have as the department to facilitate the implementation of that bill when it becomes law by the end of this year or next year even, in the course of next year? Have you, for instance, been talking to the Department of Traditional, Department of Cooperative, Department of Traditional Affairs, yeah, the department, to look how you can work together with them to ensure that the work of this court is done properly, and also even the Department of Public Works, because you will need structure in which this court will have to operate beyond the traditional structures they use, which is the trees and such like places that they use. But once this law becomes implementable, then I imagine there will be buildings that we have to put in place. Now, the relevant legislation on traditional leadership, Chairperson, talks about all departments having to work together to come up with the policies to ensure that this institution of traditional leadership is functioning. I see no reference to your strategic plan here as to what you intend to do to ensure that when that bill becomes law, you are in a position to make it work.
Thank you, Chairperson. Unlike all the learned friends, I am a rural woman with nothing, no knowledge at all of the legal issues that they were talking about. What is nice about me is that I am new, and I don't know your sins, the history that they were talking about. I only know something good about you, the determination to have an unqualified audit report. That is a very noble determination. And what I want to say is, I want to give you a few advices on how to achieve that, because it's a very difficult journey to achieve that. It needs you to start now. You need to have a very sound a corporate governance system in your department. You need to have a very strong internal controls in place. You need to have a very organized communication with strategy with the Auditor General on an ongoing basis. You know, I have been chairperson for finance for 9 years, and I have had people, you know, worried about the Auditor General. But you know, every time we called people, they always had reasons. Usually they spare their reasons to give them to SCOPA. It's not a nice thing to go to SCOPA. And I don't want this department to go to SCOPA. All your reasons, all your impediments, all your frustrations, give them to this department on an ongoing basis. Because you remember that in 1998, we moved away from the Exchequer Act ourselves as this country. We went to the Public Finance Management Act.
Why did we do that? We wanted a system that would actually show us results of the monies of the state that we have spent. Because you remember in the old exchequer, it was, yes, I got 10 rand, here's the receipt. That is how it was done. But now we want to see the results. But we came out with the Public Finance Management Act. And that act emphasizes one thing, timely reporting. A report can be good. If it is late, it is no good. Because why are we making reports? Why are we writing reports in the first place? Before we even think of the Portfolio Committee of the Auditor General, the department writes or produces its own financial statements. The Auditor General only audit. You produce your own financial statement because financial statements are nothing else but management tools. If you want to move from here to there, you've got to have a tool, and that is your tool. So you must have that desire to have up-to-date financial information on time. And as a portfolio committee, we are there for you. We want to help you. But we ourselves, we can only help you if we hear your financial, your performance information on time, on a regular basis. That is the secret. Coming to the Auditor General, you know, I worked for about 17 years in an audit firm, in audit firms, and I've been an audit clerk for quite some time. Auditors are the most patient professionals that you can ever come across. They don't just write reports. They research when they write reports. They convince themselves. And in the case of the Auditor General, they make use of what they call management letters. And if you can remember, they produce a lot of those. They ask a question, they write a letter for every question. If you can religiously answer those questions, I'm telling you, you will have no qualified report, because the auditors themselves, they don't like qualifying reports. They don't like it. It's something that they do as the last resort. So if you respond to their management letters, don't ignore any query, any correspondence from the Auditor General. Even if it's difficult, even if you think already it sounds not correct, sit down with the Auditor General. Make him understand or her understand the situation the way yourself understand it. You'll have no qualified report. But you might have, you know, behaved financially correct during the course of the year. But the Auditor General may not be convinced. He might be having a different view of the matter. But as long as you have not cleared this misunderstanding, he is not going to say, I have convinced myself that the financial statements actually represent the activities of the institution for the year under review. Because that is the sentence that they love to write. The qualification, you are actually offending them to cause them to write the qualification. So I would like you to do that, and I like you to inform us on an ongoing basis, on time, because you can only correct a financial situation within a given time. The law says quarterly reports. We need to have your information on at least on a quarterly. Where I was chairperson for finance, they used to give me information on a monthly basis. Every month I used to know the state of the department. You can do it. The accountant general has got information every month. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Response from the DG. Can I propose that we move over to dealing with the budget proper? Letter on answer this bunch first and then come in.
Just the constitutional development. It's money's going up quite a bit. What are they going to do? Have you met with particularly the Human Rights Commission to discuss potential overlaps? Just that one. Then you've got a new department for the Chief Justice, who's the DG. How is accounting to Parliament going to work? Because, if it's a new department, unless you're DG of both of them, how is it going to link up with the Department of Justice? And then lastly, maybe it's a question for the next round, but I couldn't find the section in the estimates of national expenditure how much you've allocated to the implementation of the Protection of Personal Information Bill.
In providing answers, we'll start with Dr. De Beer, Johan, and then on the unqualified audit report, we can only acknowledge and thank the honorable member and commit ourselves to making ourselves available to seek guidance from time to time, but also just assure this committee and the honorable members that we are trying to work on our relationship with the Office of the Auditor General as well as the Accountant General. In particular, the Office of the Auditor General specifically, we think that our relationship is such that they can tell us where we are going wrong without packaging it in any manner or form, and we can engage on the subject, but if it comes to a point, ultimately we respect their rights of a final opinion as granted to them by the legislation. So we want to create a relationship with that office. We are creating a relationship with that office, but we again remain available to yourselves in general, but specifically to your leadership in guiding us to move forward. Thank you.
Chair, if I may pick up on a few issues. On the issue of security, we are engaging the security company. In fact, we are moving to a new format where on a monthly basis, I think the DG has instructed that on a monthly basis, we should now be compiling monthly reports so that, you know, we should monitor services and so on, because in terms of the service level agreements that we sign with them, there are certain standards that they must meet. But I must also indicate that because of our budget constraints, there have been instances where in a court we'll have 6 to 8 guards. But because we wanted to cover more courts, we actually reduced the number of guards. But we're excited with the issue that the Director General indicated on. In fact, she has mandated me to interact with both SAFs and Defence on this matter. I think it was last week in my meeting with SAFs, they have now offered, even though we have not finalized it, but they have now offered to say in all the courts that are adjacent to the police stations, we should now come to an arrangement where SAFs must just be responsible, because they feel that it's problematic for SAFs to share that area with a security company. And I think that will assist us to redeploy and increase the number of guards. So, yeah, thanks for that question. On the question of the particularly office accommodation, I mean, I take your point that this office accommodation is badly needed, but the budget is minimal. The main reason why we are badly in need of office accommodation is because of the service delivery challenges and demands on our courts and other services that we provide. We had to increase our establishment. And because we increase our establishment, unfortunately we find ourselves in a position where our accommodation is not increasing in the same way. So maybe when the budget presentation commences by Acting CFO, you'll just indicate how constrained we are financially, because in fact we are constrained. As recently as last week, I think we had to make some shifts in our budget to accommodate leases, to accommodate municipal services, and so on and so forth. And lastly, on the question of the TRC, Honorable Sibanyoni, I will take your offer. We tried to use the GCIS before on this matter, but I don't think the results were very satisfactory. So we will take up your offer. Thanks very much. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. A number of answers from my side. On maintenance, we've done appropriate costing of our maintenance backlog, and we've calculated it to be around about 1.027 billion rand. Now, it's 334, 335, and 355 million over 3-year period. We don't have the mandate budget in our baseline. When I do a presentation later, you'll see what is the provision for facilities management, meaning in total, but in the context of where we are as the economy, we could not go to Treasury and say, please, assist us with a billion rand for maintenance. We've asked them for funding for security, for IT, so it's just a question of prioritization. In terms of our office accommodation, in the estimates of national expenditure, there's a sub-program called office accommodation. Now, this is payment that we do to public works for office rental, municipal rates and taxes, and you might observe a substantial increase in this budget. I think in the current financial, around about 508 million, we've increased about 22% to 623 million. It's because of a special increase in municipal rates and taxes. In relation to the Sexual Offences Act,
Mr. Chair, I have to follow up on that question. That wasn't my question, how much you've got for maintenance. My question was, have you done some kind of study as to what are the most urgent needs with the money you have for maintenance? So we don't have a situation like, for example, Pretoria burning down, that kind of thing. Had you checked what courts are most urgently in need of maintenance and then prioritise accordingly? That was the question.
How do we see the status of our various courts? There is a user asset management plan prescribed. Now, it is an assessment of our courts, so we've done a conditional assessment of all our courts. Now, it is various courts in various communities they are competing. We, for instance, couldn't foresee that suddenly there was a need for substantial investment for our Randburg court when there was a problem there. So, for us with facilities management and within public works, try to address the critical needs, but the point I want to make is there was a conditional assessment for each and every court, and that assessment informs spending on maintenance and rehabilitation of individual courts. In relation to sexual offences, we've got a budgetary provision for the implementation of various pieces of legislation. Child Justice Act, and especially sexual offences, the Sexual Offences Act. Our baseline makes provision, this is in all positions, 130 more intermediary approving positions to assist with implementation of the Sexual Offences Act. In relation to the Protection of Information Bill, while Honourable Member Jeffrey is around, yes, we've put aside over the MTF 18 million rand for the implementation of the Act. Surely, from finance, we have to get better information. Based on the national information, I think there is a budget we could do over 3, 5, 6, 7 million, and as better information becomes available, we'll make additional allocations available. Thank you.
So just to add a few answers to questions that have been raised, I think the first one relates to the question raised by the Honourable Mr. Swart and in relation to the Office of the Chief Justice. The effect of the proclamation of the office of the CJ to be a department, I think with effect from the 3rd of September last year, meant that it would be a separate department with its own accounting officer who would report directly, you know, to the Chief Justice. And in this case, that the responsibility in relation to the administration of that office rests with the SG and no longer with the department. That is an eventual situation that in terms of the creation of that office it was envisaged. But however, I just need to, sorry? Oh, sorry, the Secretary General, I just, I think you prefer the term Secretary General instead of the Director General. But I think I'm just going to make sure that it is going to be a process to have a fully independent and functional department of the office of the CJ. Given the fact that this office and the department is also established under the current prevailing legislative framework, which is the Public Service Act, as well as under the PFMA. So it is serious to utilize what government utilizes in terms of regulating its affairs. And so the understanding was that as well the department will play a leading role in terms of supporting it towards ensuring that this department becomes fully functional, at least by the beginning of April, you know, this new beginning of the financial year and so on. So at the moment as we speak, because it's a department with no systems in place, it's a department that also relies in terms of the department of DOJ and CD to support it in terms of its fully function. But it is envisaged that if everything goes well according to the plan, that at least by the beginning of the next financial year, that department would have a separate accounting system separate from the Department of Justice. Then the other related issues that have been raised around the maintenance issues, I think we haven't spoken much, and I think maybe this will come much clearer when we present our, I'm talking about the family related services now on maintenance, because there is a project which we call Isondlo. That project was established some time ago, and part of the objective of that project is also to utilize the existing legislative framework in terms of enforcing, you know, in fact, in terms of some of the issues that we've been able to assist people that we have attached a number of properties belonging and also pensions money belonging to the people that are supposed to pay maintenance. So we are to a limited extent utilizing the rate of execution that is available in terms of the existing framework in the High Court. And similarly, I guess with the regional courts now having had this jurisdiction from 100 to 3 million, it's also enabling that we also utilize in this regard. So I think this will come quite clearly when we present our plan in relation to maintenance issues. In relation to the case backlog, I think I have indicated that our baseline when we started this project was more than 44,000 cases that were behind. And I think that was the baseline that we started in 2006. Now in this financial year, which one that is going to end on the 31st of March this year, our target that I've indicated that we have put in our strategy to finalize is that because last year we were only able to finalize about 11,500 cases, but this year we have set for ourselves a target of 14,815 cases to be finalized. So in terms of the, and this is but one of the projects, as the DG has indicated, that we have significant progress in relation to this. In fact, as at the end of December 2010, we had finalized 12,702 cases. So we are well above the 50% of this, and that's why I think it's one of those areas that I think we have a bit of progress in this regard. And I think we've taken note in terms of the data that seems to be not consistent in some of the issues that we've reported on, but I think in this year we've tried to improve on that, and hence what I'm just giving you, those are the real figures in terms of the productivity of this particular, you know, project. Chair, the other issue relates to our readiness for the implementation of the traditional courts bill. I must say that from the department's point of view, this is but one of the bills that has been delayed quite significantly, and it has a very negative impact on the ground in terms of expectations that have been created from the houses of the traditional leaders, because it wasn't expected that it was going to take such a long period. Of course, in submitting this bill to Parliament, we have worked together with all of the relevant departments, including the department that is responsible for the traditional affairs, as well as the houses, the different houses of the traditional leaders. And so, depending on the final version that Parliament would approve on this, because we don't know ultimately exactly what the final version of this legislation is going to look like. But our plans when we envisaged this legislation was that we were going to mainstream in terms of administration. I'm not talking about the decision-making process in the traditional courts. But we're going to mainstream these courts with our existing magistrates' court. In other words, where we are required to provide additional administrative support, to a court, a traditional court, will utilize what I think in terms of what was envisaged in the legislation was that there should be registrars for those kind of courts to manage the inflow of cases. So the idea was that we will utilize and match them with the existing magistrates' court to ensure that that capacity on an incremental basis eventually is created, so that those courts can also be regarded as self-standalone courts in the longer term thing. Now, the issue around the infrastructure, which is a main challenge, and I think when we presented this bill, we did indicate this, that given the approach that the restorative nature and the way in which dispute gets resolved in the courts, one is not going to change the house, or perhaps if people are meeting under trees, you're not going to immediately erect a courthouse. But what we had recommended, what we would recognize, that these courts can continue operating under the same kind of infrastructure that they have, but of course incrementally, as a department, working towards ensuring that we create an appropriate circumstances under which they have to operate. So I would not say that from the first year of these implementations, this court will all fund houses or courts to operate under. We'll utilize what is existing, and I think given what exists in provinces, but where it is possible, we'll try and assist in terms of giving them sufficient resources in terms of accommodation where it is possible. Chair, I think the issue why this is not reflected in our strategy, and I think we must say there are many things that are not reflected in our strategy, but the approach that we've taken in this strategy was that we will prioritize, because we didn't want to come up with too many objectives that have become unmanageable. The other work that the department carries on will continue to be reported on separately from this document, the plan that has been presented. So the fact that this is omitted from the main document in terms of the strategic plan does not necessarily mean that it's no longer a priority of the department in that regard. So I just thought that I think those are the issues that I just wanted to add from the questions that, answers that have been given. Thanks, Chair.
There's more follow-up questions.
I'm going to allow it, but please, honourable members, look at your watches. I had hoped we would stop at 4:30. And that leaves us with just on an hour for the budget numbers itself. But please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. As I understand it, in spite of the fact that the bill has not been passed, this court continues to operate. I would imagine, therefore, that you would have something to report about that, if you are interacting with them as a department. Like, for instance, there's justice that they defend even as we speak, in spite of the absence of this piece of legislation. And I'm saying, Jefferson, we should be getting a report as to what is happening in that regard, as a matter of course.
So, one of the dilemma with regard, because these courts, it is indeed, they are in operation, but they are in operation with different legal systems that are not even integrated. And so, in fact, the role of the department is also picked differently from province to province. So it is in that context that I was just saying that if one were to look at the more uniform way in terms of how these courts are going to be resourced, it will be under this new bill that is being proposed. But currently, it's more ad hoc in nature, and it's also dependent in terms of how the current legislations are being worded. So, but I didn't want to make, say, I mean, make a point that these courts are not recognized as they operate, because there is legislation governing those courts. But as I've said, as a department at this stage, there isn't any mandate that we are playing significant in supporting those courts as they exist, because they are informed by the different legislative framework as currently operates.
Chair, thank you. I'll be very brief. Just on the Maintenance Act, the older members of Parliament will recall that when we rewrote the Maintenance Act a few years ago, which was approved by Parliament, we specifically indicated that we will, after a number of years, review the Act. Now, just for information, the Minister has recently approved that we approach the South African Law Reform Commission to put on their programme a project entitled Review of the Maintenance Act, which was accepted, and they have started that process. So we will be reviewing the Maintenance Act or the Law Reform Commission, and I'm sure that a number of these practical problems that have been identified will be addressed during that review. Just on the Chapter 9 institutions, Chair, as far as the Kahr-Ashmore report is concerned, as far as I know, Parliament has not yet debated that report and has not yet approved that report. But you will recall that we do have a bill on our program, the South African Law Reform Commission Amendment Bill, precisely to give effect to the problem that was identified, namely that the bill, the act was written under the previous constitution or the interim constitution, and we have to bring that act in line with the new constitution. We have a bill on the table. We did consult with the previous Human Rights Commission, and we've also now consulted with the new Human Rights Commission, and they've made a number of suggestions for amendment to the bill. But quite recently, our Deputy Minister requested us to look at the Kahr-Ashmore report and to see whether we can implement some of those recommendations that can possibly be deemed not to be controversial. So we are looking at the report, and that is why we have a further delay in the finalization of the Human Rights Commission Act. As far as the Gender Commission is concerned, Chair, that legislation has been transferred to the Department of Women, Children and Persons with Disability, but the same problems apply, correctly so, the same problems apply to that act as well. And it was our intention that once we have finalized the Human Rights Commission Act, we will make that available to that department so that they can also look at that legislation to bring the Gender Commission legislation in line with the Human Rights Commission legislation.
Chair, just one last issue on the constitutional development as a branch in the department and the potential overlaps between ourselves and the Human Rights Commission. The actual consultations, we haven't done them as yet. We've spoken just in broad terms, but we haven't consulted on a specific basis in terms of the functions and the responsibilities of the new constitutional development branch. What do we envisage the branch responsibilities to be? In the business case that was developed for the department to prepare for constitutional development branch, we've articulated quite a number of broad functions, and those functions in the main are speaking to the, if I may use an example, the public engagements around a whole range of issues, for instance issues of racism and xenophobia, which we are supposed to be championing in terms of our responsibilities, in terms of the international protocols that we are a party to. But over and above that, it's just general advisory capacity that this branch must provide to us at the department, but also broadly to government in terms of what is happening in courts, which way are constitutional court decisions going, what is the implication or implications of those court decisions, and then advise us accordingly. That is the second aspect of responsibilities. The third, and I'm not articulating all of them, Chair, if you allow me, I'll just deal with these three. The third one relates to the public or civic engagement around issues of human rights, and in no specific terms, either on issues that we are piloting legislation on issues, for instance, if we talk about maintenance issues, if we talk about sexual offences issues, this is the branch that we are going to be using to engage the public to gather responses which we need to gauge our effectiveness or otherwise as we implement the new finalized legislation that we have to implement as we move forward. And so those are that in the main, Chair, the function, there are the open functions, and we do have to consult broadly as we finalize the branch. Thank you very much, Chair.
There's an overlap. I mean, the first function, there's an overlap with Human Rights Commission, because their responsibility is promoting the Bill of Rights. And things like equality clause and sort of not having racism is an overlap with that. So my concern, and it's something we've been raising since last year, my concern then is if there hasn't been discussion with the Human Rights Commission, that's a problem, because potentially you could be overlapping. We had when you still had your KPIs, one of the KPIs was implementation of PIA, which is a Human Rights Commission responsibility in terms of PIA, and it just is a problem. We're going to ask them when they come. I think they come, do they come this week or next week? No, next time. Next time, that's in April. Please, I would really hope you've spoken to them by then to eliminate overlaps.
In essence, linked to when you as committee deliberate on the appropriation bill and look at the estimates of national expenditure. I'm prepared to engage your researchers on and to respond to the questions that you raise, because the estimates of national expenditure give you a higher level indication of expenditure per program and not necessarily in sub-program, and yet not necessarily detailed. So what this presentation tried to do is to give you a sense of what is in the maroon book, the estimates of national expenditure, and a little bit more detail. I'll focus on the vote, the programs, our branches, our regions, give you a sense of what we tend to spend on facilities management and just on what is our medium-term budget spending pressures. The first slide gives you a sense of the growth in our departmental budget allocation. It is 6.3%. If wage increases is 5.5%, in next year there's not a lot of new money for expansion of capacity, but it's quite obvious with 11.5% growth in 2012-2013, there deals with new money coming in. Again, go to the next slide. I think surely as a committee you've assisted us here substantially. This is a slide that gives us a sense of what new money Treasury and Parliament and Cabinet approved for us. The first one is implementation cost of new legislation. It's sexual offences, child justice, Children Court Act implementation, and you can see the 85 million, 90 million. Expanding our capacity at regional level, new appointments at court level, the construction of new courts, 240 million, 250 million. Now, this one of our two major infrastructure projects is a court in Nelspruit and in Limpopo, the two high courts, and this nearly 500 million will assist there. Renewal of IT infrastructure, 100 million, 110 million. And from our side, a good allocation from National Treasury is the appointment cost of new judges and magistrates. and also the cost of funding those those appointees. The presidential initiative, 30 million, 50 million, in essence this relates to a project from the president called the Nation in Dialogue. It started this year and will be for the next 3 years. Then there was our increase in the cost of our personnel, some OSD related and some because of improved conditions of service. And there you can see the money that was allocated. I think one also, allocation that we surely appreciate is the municipal services, because our budgets used to increase with 5-7%, whilst our local authorities increasing at 15-16% up to 20%, and that will assist. So it's quite obvious, nearly 3 billion, no, just over 2.5 billion that we receive over our baseline, in addition to our baseline and over the MTF. There were also some budget cuts. We suspended the third party funds, public private partnership, and that money Treasury has now taken back. And then early December, there were further 3 budget cuts affected by Cabinet. Because we are managing the votes, important maybe just to give you a sense of what's happening in our cluster entities, entities under our vote. For the Legal Aid Board, there was new money, and soon once they get to you, they'll reflect that 40 and 50 million, what new capacities they'll be buying. For the SIU, again, you can see some new additional capacity, appointment of additional personnel. Also, the public protector, they complained previously about resource constraints, and you can see the, especially for the municipal and accommodation charges, the Office of the Public Protector received some substantial funding, and also the Human Rights Commission. So those are the entities that reports to the Minister of Justice, or was under the vote of justice, for which additional funding has been allocated. But all our members, Treasury continuously put before us, and they say we must work a bit smarter and reduce our cost. We are also on the receiving end of reducing budgets. They've done some budget cuts, and they call it efficiency gains. It is things where we, for instance, this meeting of this morning started at 10, assisted us, because instead of staying over last night, we could flew in this morning. And we need to cut down on our telecommunication costs and the excessive fringes in our environment. But surely this is just your indication of what was the extent of the Treasury cuts. The main thing is medium-term budget policy statement. I spoke to Justice when he says there's a number of things that U.S. you need to do. You need to reduce spending on non-core functions and activities. So there's a reason why from our baseline we managed to fund a number of things. We can spend, by cutting down the telecommunication costs, we can spend money in document management as dedicated projects. We indicated to us that we must weed out poorly performing programs, we must reform our procurement systems, and we must also change the culture of the public service to reduce waste and prevent extravagant spending on shoddy work and corruption. In the appropriation bill, this will be the figures that you will be confronted with. In essence, the budget of justice, the total for the program somewhere in the middle, increased from 10.7 billion rand to 11.4, 12 billion, 13 billion over the next 3 years. And something below the line, which is a direct charge against the National Revenue Fund, is a compensation for judges and magistrates. The next slide shows you our various programs, and I think it's an important point that this slide with the lines to try to reflect you, as you can see that the growth in our budget is in essence in court service. It would have been highly problematic if our growth were in the program administration and support service. So you can see the growth, if you look at the trend, our court services program and our national prosecuting program, there is a substantial growth. The next slide perhaps is more detailed. It gives you a sense of the budget allocations for economic classifications. And for us, it gives just an indication that there's limited growth on our operational budget, but there is some increase in our compensation budget, also some increase in our budget for bills and fixed taxes. But perhaps the picture again shows you, Chairperson, that our budget growth has been driven by a rise in personnel cost And strangely, there was a year in 2019, where there was substantial expenditure and then a dip in expenditure. The reason for the 19 substantial increase is, and this year we've paid back dated OSD costs back to July to 27 or 28. And the reason why there was a substantial increase in that financial year. In your estimates of national expenditure, you will see the first program that we are funding is Program 1 Administration. One area that you possibly are interested in is one for office accommodation. You can see the budget increase from 508 million to 623 million. Because under office accommodation, we pay our leases and municipal rates, minimum rates and taxes. Office accommodation is a treasury prescript. They prefer that we use a program, the name office accommodation. Under corporate service, they'll get the spending on HR, finance and IT. But those are the major sub-programs under administration. The biggest portion of the budget, you can see that we are allocating money is for corporate services in this program. The next program is Program 2 Court Services, and it reflects how much we spend in the Constitutional Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal and all our respective high courts. I mean, what is quite evident is a substantial portion of our budget are being spent on lower courts, in fact 61%. Surely because of the number of courts, we should spend more on lower courts. We've cut down on government motor transport just to fund other operations. And this pie chart again reflects lower courts getting the bigger portion, about 61% of of the budget. The third program that we are responsible for is for state legal services. And there you can see the spending on state law advisory services, litigation services. The program with the biggest impact here is the Master of the High Court, based on the personnel, a new sub-program called Constitutional Development. The budget stays stable around about 65 million, 64 million, then it goes down for 42 to 49 million, because this presidential project, Nation and Dialogue, are being funded on a short term or for periodically under this sub-program. And you can see Master of the High Court taking the bigger chunk of the budget for this program. On Program 4, Program 4 does not the DG Justice, the oversight there for this supplement, this program, is the National Director of Public Prosecutions. But because it is a vote and the DG is responsible for it, you can see that the biggest portion of this budget is being spent on public prosecutions. There is a provision for asset forfeiture and for witness protection, but 72% the pie chart reflect is spending on the operational costs and the funding of the salaries for the prosecutors. Then there's a number of entities that we are funding mainly through transfer payments. South African Human Rights Commission, you can see the increase in the budget from 74 to 89 million, the SIU. Legal Aid Board, there might be a question, why is the Legal Aid Board's budget going down with 4 million? The reason for it going down is in this year there was a once-off adjustment for them to again fund phase 2 of OSD. Also, expenditure, but they will possibly explain to you why there is a 4 million dip. But it's because there was a once-off backdated payment. We spend a lot of money on justice modernization. Now, this is our expenditure on IT. From of that 400 million in 2011-12, a greater portion, 140 million, will go to spending on correctional services, spending within the NPA, spending in social development. This allocation for the integration of the IT systems lies minimalized with justice. There is a allocation for represented political parties fund, and we transfer this payment to Home Affairs that will eventually transfer it to the IEC. We think there can be different arrangement going forward. Why should this allocation be on the justice vote? Then a strange one, the President's Fund. The President's Fund, there is a provision for 1,000 rand, but in the fund itself, there is approximately 1.032 billion rand. Now, we just keep the sub-program alive if there's any additional appropriation from Parliament, we can activate this sub program, but we don't see a lot of movement in this fund. And then you can see the legal aid board getting a substantial portion. This is perhaps detail if I can on the various branches, and hopefully what I want to show you through this slide, maybe one or two percentages, is a line called number 10, court services. The average growth over the next 3 years on the budget of the department is around about 8%. But court services, their budget, the annual average increase is around about 12%. You'll see a support service like the chief financial officer, their budget decreasing with 14%. Why? Because we used to have this 100 million rand for the public-private partnership. It's no longer with us. So over time, the budget decreased. The Justice College, you also see a reduction in the budget there. Why? Because the money for the training of judges and magistrates moved to the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court will now take responsibility for judicial training. This indication of the budget for the various regions. Regional budgets are essentially informed by personnel numbers in the number of courses, primary course drivers. Surely Gauteng has got more personnel than the Northern Cape, and their budget should be proportionally more. Transfer payments, this is money that we pay over to other entities, and I'm making the point that they've got separate accountability and reporting frameworks. In an appropriate time, they will come to you as a committee and explain their strategic direction and in spending of the funds. Earmarked amounts, and I think perhaps here I want to highlight two allocations. For earmarked amounts is funds, we can't use it without Treasury approval. The one is Integrated Justice Program, 140 million in 2011-12. What it reflects, as I've told you before, it reflects members, the allocation for investment in IT so that SAPS and police and correctional service and home affairs can talk, these systems can talk. Then the allocation for case backlog reduction, you can see there within our vote is 224 million. Out of that, Justice got 74 million, NPA and the Legal Aid Board got a specific allocation. But from Treasury side, I think this is a project allocation. It has been on our baseline for 4 or 5 years now. It's Treasury can easily over a year or two says, there's no longer need for such a project. So this is a major project assisting us from clearing our case backlog. Our biggest challenge was the competing needs of your rural courts and your courts for in the metropolitan areas, the Randburg courts and the Pretoria courts, is what do we spend on facilities management? Then those are the total provision for upgrading of infrastructure. This is new network points, rehabilitation and day-to-day maintenance. The day-to-day maintenance allocation, 27 million, we allocated to court level, where court manager can, when there's a broken window, broken toilet, can have many services rendered. So this is just the total portfolio of facilities management. We've shared some detail on this, but I think it's important maybe to reflect on in response to the President's call, firstly our challenge would be to fill all our vacant positions. The second challenge is we must expand our establishment, and we are looking at regional capacity to at core level have more staff available, and we believe over the MTF period we can create 200 new positions at court. On strengthening our key risk area of supply chain and third party funds, we will appoint 19 new officials at a regional level to assist our oversight and monitoring. Maintenance investigators are based on my provision for 65 new posts. The intermediary is related to sexual offences, 130 new posts. And for the various pieces of legislation, children's court and child justice, you can see what is the various provisions there. The Legal Aid Board needs to come to you and say how many candidates, attorneys, say we plan to appoint with the 40 million and 50 million allocated. What is our major infrastructure projects over the next 3 years? The one is Limpopo Court in Polokwane. Our budget over the next 3 years is 417 million. I think the total estimated cost, spending will be around about 478 million on this court, but for the next 3 years, 417 million has been put aside. We believe there will be indirect benefits like the local construction industry can get a benefit and employ a number of people. When these courts are finished, there will be need to do some investment in terms of judges and also appointing administrative staff. The same way that Mpumalanga High Court in Nelspruit, the indirect spin-offs will be a number of posts that will be created. We've highlighted perhaps some of these cost pressures for us, and I mean surely during the budget process this year, and as we will engage you during the process, the MTF and later, I mean for us still there's a number of costs, things like library services, and the one that will be picked up, language services, municipal rates and taxes, those are the things that will still be, will persist in being cost pressures going forward. Now, what are we doing about financial management? There is, on the operational side or the resource allocation, 2-3 slides, and I think it relates to what the member previously said. If we want to turn around financial management chapters in this department, we need to look at things like governance, and there, as previously communicated, we need to look at our audit capacity, our internal control. Our challenge going forward will be, our people, we need to appoint people, we need to ensure that few people are trained. We need to look at our systems. For ICT is reforming our systems on third-party fund management and even the procurement systems within a vote and one specific area of financial training. So what we've done is we've constructed, a plan in terms of financial turnaround, and this is the four pillars of the turnaround strategy. I think one of the pillars on governance for us is also the oversight by your committee. This today and tomorrow, the SCOPA is visiting our courts in Malanga and in KZN, and tomorrow they will be in London and then in Limpopo. But this one area that assists, because I think most of those court managers are ready because SCOPA is coming, and I think you can assist us. And we are quite, I believe the department is quite keen to get you involved in as part as you do your oversight to assist. Okay. So, supplement many interventions in terms of the vote. We say we must integrate our planning. We are fortunate that we've got a staff partnership and technical assistance with National Treasury. In fact, Treasury delegated assigned a person to assist us on technical level. We need to provide capacity in there, the position is clear. We need to provide capacity operational level, supply chain management, asset management. We've got 90 interns working with us now on asset management. We need to fill our senior management positions. We can confirm that they've been processed there in terms of financial management. Irregular expenditure, our audit report reflects irregular expenditure, non-compliance with the PPPFA policy, and we've applied triple BEE. And we need to regularize it now. We've trained our people. There's some interventions to prevent the reoccurrence of the regular expenditure. Lastly, so this slide relates to what we do in terms of the vote. Financial management in terms of the third party fund, I think for us the major achievement would be if we can have credible, good financial statements for the first time on third party funds. We've said previously, for the past 20 years, it was never concluded. And now the first step is to have baseline financial reporting. We need to do a systems review and update. Sometimes we are failing in the third party fund system because somebody in the systems level on a daily basis are not checking whether there is appropriate cash in the my cash flow reconcile. So that is what we want to beef up. We want to financial capacity and training. We've got now a program. Over the next 6 months, we're going to train 200 officials. It's area court managers and financial operating managers. What do you do? You sit with the street billionaire. What do you do on a daily basis as far as a general manager overseeing the function? And I think, lastly, we need to improve our internal controls, management oversight, daily reconciliations, and exception reporting. Chairperson, thank you very much.
Get the two together because they overlap. But just some initial comments. I don't understand. I mean, your page is unfortunately not numbered. But let's go to the job creation initiatives.
Sorry?
Not on mine.
Yeah.
23rd of March, this one. Okay. Anyway, it's near the back, called Major Infrastructure Projects, and you're going to appoint 6 judicial officers and 38 administrators will be appointed in 2011 in Mpumalanga. Where are they going to be? You haven't started building the court yet. You're only going to start building the court next year. And I think Limpopo you haven't finished. I don't know, the 2011, is that the 2011 financial year or the 2011 calendar year? But how accurate is that for both of them? I mean, Limpopo is budgeted for, it's underway. The report here somewhere in the documentation is delays because of flooding. But I think it's only going to be completed next year. So these 6 judges and 43 administrators, what are they going to do? Is this accurate? And then it's worse with Mpumalanga, which you haven't even started building yet. So how accurate is that? I think that the SCOPA report that, I mean, just going back to you know, you Mr. Johnson spoke about the importance of oversight. It makes it easier for us to perform oversight if you have, as I've raised earlier, a, you know, we're on the same page rather than we get a new page each time you come. And I think it would be useful if the SCOPA report that the House adopted last week, you've got in terms of that House resolution a period within which you've got to respond, but it would be useful for us as the portfolio committee to know your initial responses to it in terms of what you're doing. I think basically, oh yeah, then the other point, this you've saved millions by cancelling the PP public-private partnership on the third-party funds. That's great. But what worries me is, well, what's replaced it? And all I can sort of see is 90 new positions which are costing you 29 million rand. And it doesn't make me feel more secure knowing that the problem is being dealt with. I mean, the saving is good. And then I think the other point was just again, I don't have numbers, but on the fourth page, it's this baseline adjustments. Why are the municipal and accommodation charges for the public protector and the Human Rights Commission so divergent? So 2011, 13 million for municipal and accommodation charges for the public protector, and 1 million, 1.5 million for the Human Rights Commission. And basically that. I think let me leave that for now. Yeah, that's it.
Just one question: why was the PPP decided that it wasn't the best option? And how much has been spent on it to date? Because it's been budgeted for the last number of years. What's happened to that money?
I may. I'm referring to the SCOPA report. I sincerely hope the Bosasa issue is not part of the SCOPA report.
No.
Well, it doesn't say that. It doesn't refer to any particular company or service provider, but some of the stuff here is just not three price quotations, not in all instances invited, and so on. So I do agree with Mr. Jeffrey, DG, that whilst the National Assembly has given you 60 days, well, within 60 days, to submit a progress report, it would assist us as a committee if a report could be provided even before then. Some of the issues raised here are quite a worry. Yes, Joseph.
In response to Ms. Schaefer's question, I mean, you can answer it. I don't have any problem. That's about, you know, how much has been spent on the PPP and why has it been mothballed. But it's maybe a broader question. This budget review and recommendation report that we adopted and the House adopted, what are you doing with it? When are we going to get a response? Because one of the issues is the committee recommends, this is page 16, this is numbered, the department with National Treasury brief it on its plan to resolve this matter. This is on the third party funds. Details of wasted costs relating to the, in inverted commas, mothballed, close inverted commas, PPP initiative, if any, should be provided. That's Ms. Schaefer's question. So really the point I'm making is that if you had responded to this, she wouldn't have to be asking the question. And I don't want you to answer the question verbally and maybe give us, I mean, and then think you've answered it, whereas we need a detailed response to this report.
I Mr. Jeffrey actually interrupted. I had another question or two. It's about 2 or 3 months ago, the media reported that the register of sex offenders wasn't compiled because of budgetary constraints. Now, my office is being overhauled, so I have mislaid that media report. But I can assure you that there was such a report. Mr. Johnson referred to implementation of legislation and the allocated amount there. I assume that the compilation of the register is included therein. And if it is, then how soon can we expect the relevant people to have access to that register?
Chairperson, honourable members, the first question in relation to the various high courts, the provision there for judiciary and appointed staff. For us, we cannot do the planning for the appointment of those staff when these courts are operational. Ideally, for us, we need from finance, we need to get an early indication of the number of judges to be appointed. And also the number of staff that is needed. So that was an indication from us. We haven't put aside now money for those positions because it's quite obvious there's delays in the conclusion of the construction of these various courts.
Yeah, I've got no idea what you're talking about. You could have come and told us in your presentation that there are going to be, that you've said, and I'll read it, Limpopo High Court. 6 judicial officers, 43 administrators will be appointed during 2011 when the High Court start operations at the interim leased premises. Okay, is that happening? Have you got interim leased premises? Okay.
Yes.
Then you've got for Mpumalanga, so okay, maybe you've taken care of Limpopo. But what I don't understand is that Mpumalanga, 6 judicial officers and 38 administrators will be appointed in 2011. You haven't even started building the court yet. Where are those? Are you going to have interim leased premises somewhere?
Yes.
In Nelspruit?
Yes.
Then why don't you tell us that?
If I can continue,
then where is the other cost? You lease premises, presumably you're going to need an infrastructure. Where's the budget? Where's the spending for that? So when will the Limpopo High Court be operational?
Sorry. Perhaps in answering that question as to when will it be operational, please remember that the court is already operational. It's just a new building because it is operating, and I stand to be corrected, but from an old building.
We were told that people were, you know, that well, there was no Limpopo High Court, but that people were going to Pretoria North.
Yeah.
Or Gauteng North. Yeah. Okay, that's what we've been told before. Now are you telling us that there is a Limpopo High Court? Simply in Mpumalanga, is there a Mpumalanga High Court, or are they not also going to Gauteng South or North?
Chair, the Limpopo situation is that we have a second court. In other words, it's the current North Gauteng that is operating there on a second basis. Of course, there is a building that was constructed about 2 or 3 years ago, which provides, interim accommodation, but it's not a fully functional court as envisaged as the High Court for Limpopo. Now, I think the reference here to the Pulopono one, we are talking about the new building there. For the new court that is going to be designated for Limpopo, and of course that construction is at an advanced stage. I think we are in the stage that this building will be completed next year in terms of its operation. Now, as far as the Nelspruit, I think it's also the similar arrangement that has been done. Nelspruit, we speak to you now. We are busy with the tenants installation for the court. To be operational. In fact, we are envisaging that by June, the replacement should be completed, and that court should also, on an interim basis as a second court, be operational in terms of this. So what I think Mr. Johnson has indicated in terms of the Mpumalanga High Court, that 407, that is the establishment of a new High Court, that is the building. I don't know whether that clarifies the...
Chair, I'm aware of the building costs. What I'm getting totally confused about are these 6 judges and 43 administrators who are going to be appointed in Limpopo this year, and the 6 judges, because for a high court a judicial officer is a judge, so they must be judges, and 38 administrators that will be appointed this year. And I still must tell you, completely clueless as to what that means. Okay? You've got a circuit court, and circuit courts are usual, but that you bring the staff, the judges go on circuit. They are Gauteng judges. Okay, they're not 6 new ones that have fallen purple. And the 43 administrators, I have no idea where they come from or what they do, or the 38 in Mpumalanga. So what are those figures? How accurate are those figures? Or is it where do they come from?
If I may attempt, and this we wish to come back and just clarify in writing with the chair and this honourable house, but in just an attempt, the understanding and the planning that we are doing in the understanding that the Superior Court Bill is going to kick into effect as soon as possible. Well, if I say as soon as possible, and I don't mean this in any loose manner, but the planning was that on the understanding that we should start planning, because that's the capacity we are going to need once the courts take shape. That is the one aspect. The second aspect is that we have experienced that, for instance, if I use an example of Khamishiwe Court, where we have a physical infrastructure called a court, but we have not planned for the human resources to support that court when the court comes into effect. And in fact, when it did come into effect, we had no capacity to populate and start servicing that court with the relevant capacity. So part of the plan was done that let's plan as though those courts are going to come out of stream and we're going to populate them according to all the understanding that the legislation will come out of effect at the appropriate time, which is 2011. Thank you, Chair.
I would suggest the DG comes back. I mean, look, what I really object to is a factual statement. 6 judicial officers and 43 administrators will be appointed. Okay. When in fact, I mean, that's not the case. This is not linked to the Superior Court's bill, as far as I can see. I mean, which has only just been introduced now, and is unlikely to be finalized until the end of the year. But you don't need. Okay, I don't know why what the issue there is. I mean, it takes us time. We've got to have public hearings. The bill has just been introduced. We've waited a long time for it. Okay. Now, you don't need the bill. I mean, we were able to create Gauteng South and Gauteng North without any legislative amendment. So one of my arguments has always been I've never understood why, and I felt it was an excuse, that the non-existence of a Limpopo High Court and an Mpumalanga High Court was always linked to the Superior Court's bill, whereas it didn't appear to have caused any problems with the division of Gauteng into South and North. But be that as it may, whether we pass the bill tomorrow and get the NCOP to pass it on Thursday, the bottom line is you've got nowhere to put the people. So it's a problem of phrasing. You know, this is a section around where you're telling us about creating jobs. Okay? So please don't come and tell us that you're creating 6 new judges and 43 administrators, when in fact it you know that's not going to happen this year. You know, the jobs in the construction industry may be, but my worry with Mpumalanga, you're only starting building next year, aren't you? So I don't know why we're being told about the jobs you're creating this year. Looks good, yes, but we want to see real people. Maybe you've got your 600 in Nelspruit. I don't know why the difference. I mean, it's 150. I don't know whether labour is more expensive in Mpumalanga, or whether that's just a thumb suck. You know, okay, the Mpumalanga High Court is about 10 million more. I mean, sorry, Limpopo High Court is about 10 million more, but that's 6,000. That's 150 more jobs than Mpumalanga. So I, you know, it's a problem, we've raised it before, the quality of information you give us. And it really does, again, indicate that you're not taking us seriously. If it's sort of soma feed them anything, they'll swallow it, or we won't.
So I would assume that what they were trying to say is that they were making provision for those people to be appointed if the court was finalised, in which case they can just say the provision has been made for the appointment of 6 judicial officers and 43 administrators. And I agree, it's a question of phrasing, but it creates the wrong impression.
It's not dependent on the Superior Court's bill, because that Gauteng South and North did not need legislative amendment. And then they themselves are in charge. I mean, other documents are telling us that Mpumalanga is only starting later. I think what we need, and you know, when are we getting, can we not get something on when are we getting the Limpopo High Court? Because there's quite a bit of confusion as to, is it a Gauteng North Circuit? Yes. Which means that you then have judges of the Limpopo High Court as opposed to Gauteng North, and administrators who are then living in Polokwane working for that court rather than officials seconded from Gauteng North. And as I said, I don't buy the argument of, you know, that you will say to us, we need to tell you when we're going to pass the Superior Courts Bill, because everybody managed to set up a Gauteng North Court and divide Gauteng into South and North without any legislative provision.
Just on the point of clarity, perhaps, the two courts, the Mpumalanga and the Limpopo High Courts, are established in terms of the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, which has been approved by Cabinet and is with the state law advisors at this very moment. So as soon as they are ready to certify, we will introduce that legislation establishing those two courts.
Which bill created Gauteng North and South?
Check on that. I don't know.
Is it a statutory provision?
I think it was done in terms of a statutory provision, probably.
And then I thought Superior Courts Bill was providing for Gauteng, for Limpopo and Mpumalanga.
It will also, of course, provide for those two courts. but the courts are established in terms of the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill.
Chair, the implementation of this particular regime, I think, is done in two stages. And that's a report that the department has made. I think the first phase was that the department would look at starting to document most of the new cases that are coming in. The second phase thereof is the one that was, and I think that's the one that raised the budget issues, because that is dependent upon the availability of funds from subs, you know, from the police side of it, because they needed to also to utilize the fingerprints to track people that have been in the system, you know, I mean, that have previous convictions and so on. So that's the information that currently we are not capturing. But as we speak at the moment, there is the compilation of the register, though not complete as I've indicated, because it doesn't cater the period with previous conviction and so on. So there is someone that has already been appointed who is the registrar for the sexual offences register. So there is work that has been done in that regard.
So as I understand you, Mr. Gianni, then what has to be done is to capture the information that's in the hands of the South African police. Okay, JB and then Debbie.
On page number 5, the document talks about the Office of the Public Protector. I don't know whether my question is relevant here. The Deputy Public Protector is earning less than the CEO. There's been some concern that it should be attended to. Now, if that happens, how will it affect your baseline assessment?
I'm not the way around here, but our interpretation from finance is this is a constitutional institution, meaning with its own accountability arrangement, with its own CEO, and with its own kind of normal board. We are just a conduit for the funding. They negotiate on their own with National Treasury for funding and for their course places, and those allocations in relation to municipal charges and accommodation charges are things that they have negotiated. Our job is as a department, get the funding from Treasury and transfer the money to them.
Maybe it could go under improved conditions or service. I just wanted to ask something, now I've forgotten what. Oh yes, why are you waiting for information from the SAT on previous convictions? The convictions were done in the Justice Board. Okay? They control all the previous convictions. You have no record of injustice at all of the previous convictions for sexual offense.
No, at the moment we don't keep those, because that information lies with SAP. If a person gets convicted, I'm talking about
I don't know if I can, just because we dealt with Mr. Gianni, we dealt with that expungement bill. I mean that you apply to the DG of Justice if you want a record expunged, if you fall within the category, the requirements. You get a certificate from the DG, and then that gets sent over to the SAP to actually remove it, so they control the register. Get my question around the municipal and accommodation charges for Public Protector versus Human Rights Commission. You see, my difficulty is it would imply that the Public Protector has many more and much nicer offices than the Human Rights Commission. And they're both important. And it does, I mean, I'm not stirring, no, but you do need to look at the budget of both. And that's my concern. I mean, look, we're going to get them both along and we can ask them. I mean, I don't know why they don't share offices. They're not in conflict. except yeah. maybe the Human Rights Commission might be scared if they're sharing with the public protector, they might get visited by the police by mistake. But I mean, I don't know. I would have thought that, well, we can, I suppose we should ask that question of them ourselves. That other question, the previous slide, it's gone now. This one, I just meant to ask it, this job creation initiatives, just to, you know, when will these, which year are we talking about? So it's a page before the one I was complaining about, that one, okay? Following amounts have been earmarked for job creation within the department. You've got 200 new positions in regional court over the medium term. What's the medium term? MTF period. 90 positions in the supply chain third-party management over this financial year. No time frames, basically. I think that's crucial, otherwise it's meaningless.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've changed the slide to reflect on the regional capacity over the medium term. It's definitely 3 years. All the other main positions are within the new financial year. In fact, some of these positions we've already advertised for the new financial year. Yes.
Yes. Just to clarify the allocation made to the public protector and human rights. That the matter which was with the DPW, and there were some billing problems. And we said instead of dealing with those problems with DPW, the money will be given to those institutions to run their own buildings, then DPW will just build them. So it depends on the number of the buildings which were being run by DPW prior to 1996. So meaning that it is possible that human rights had a lot of buildings than the public contractor before 1996, which were run by DPW.
Chairperson, there was a question on the PPP. This department took a tough decision to say we've incurred expenditure, we've appointed consultants and transaction advisors, treasury assisted us with developing this PPP. 5 years later, the department says this thing is not affordable. It's against the PFMA, it's against the PPP regulations. And we are concerned about the impact on job creation. There will be possible job losses. The basic point is there will be expenditure. All the general possibly will proclaim on whether it was fruitless, and wasteful. But things changed between 2003 and 2004 when we had certain economic growth versus our position now in 2010 to 2011. So, yes, we can possibly report to you on what was the expenditure from our side on those various items as part of the project. In preparation for this PPP, it was important for us also as to do some expenditure on our own it relates to getting our documents ready for a possible transfer to the PPP. But surely we will be able to give you a report. And I think concurrently, we can prepare a response to your budget review document, and also on the SCOPA resolutions, before it is formally submitted to SCOPA, we can send such a report to you.
Thank you. A few minutes left. No, it was just, can we please get, if not now, then tomorrow, I don't know if the DG will still be here tomorrow, but a response as to when we're going to get a proper response to this budget review and recommendation report. I'm suggesting you don't tell us now, because it's a complicated document. So, you know, I'm suggesting you have some time to think about it. But One of the issues raised there was the relationship, and it is a problem with the courts, of the relationship between justice and public works. Now, some of my slides are numbered, some of them are not, but slide 27, I do have a number for that, facilities management, okay, there. Day-to-day maintenance. What's happening with, I think it was something in the BRR report that we said that we need to know, the department committee recommends that the department review its arrangement with the Department of Public Works relating to the administration, its administration of justice offices and court buildings, and report to the committee on this item in the second quarter report for 2010-11. I'm not sure what we're at the end of the 2010-11, or it's ended the financial year, so I don't know what happened to the second quarter report. But what's happening? I'm not clear. Who's responsible for the maintenance of the buildings? That would indicate, that 25 million would indicate day-to-day maintenance, that justice is doing something. Is that in fact the case? Whereas in the past it used to be public works. What is the exact position? I mean, when we go and visit a court and they complain, a prosecutor complains that the lock on the door is broken, is it from your budget or from public works that must come and fix it? The conditioning in Durban is broken, which it often does, or the lifts are broken. Who's going to fix it? Your budget or public works?
Follow up on that. If they could explain to me the actual differences between day-to-day maintenance, rehabilitation, especially between rehabilitation and upgrading infrastructure.
Day-to-day maintenance is a facility to allow court managers, when this urgent repairs broken window, to immediately fix it. Immediately, I mean, with surely getting what is delegations, a quotation to work with and fix it. Public works do have another provision called plan maintenance, where they, under their budget, have a program of maintaining their infrastructure, because these are assets of public works. So there's a plan maintenance allocation made by public works. This day to day maintenance allocation for our court managers to immediately respond. Rehabilitation is part of a program called RAMP. It's a public works program. Basically, it is going to a court in a dilapidated state and bring it back to its original state, or in an older or improved state. So, from this, there's a number of courts that our facilities management division will look at, and together with public works, do substantial investment in that. Upgrading of infrastructure relates to when there is an addition to a court building, and you need investment, I mean, an IT network point, then we fund the upgrading from, I mean, or that expenditure from that allocation. It also, in some cases, relate to the procurement of machinery and equipment for new offices in new courts. So, for instance, in the case of the court in Victoria, which burned down, we wanted to spend a lot of money by procuring more furniture, and that allocation will be utilized.
Just to get clarity, whose budget is this coming out of? These figures that are on the is that from your budget or is that from Public Works' budget?
This is absolutely our budget. We made it in consultation with Public Works. Public Works will procure services and service providers, and then they will bill us, and we will pay them.
So, in simple, more simple, so I understand, when the air conditioning breaks in the Durban Magistrates Court, you will fix it.
we'll instruct the Regional Office of Public Works to assist us in fixing it. We may put the bill, but they may be the procurement or service providers will be their responsibility.
Yeah, I don't know if that's been, and presumably when the lift breaks too. I mean, given that you're paying, given that they don't have the in-house capacity to fix it, so it's simply going to external service providers, makes it a lot more, or it's disempowering for the people in those buildings, in those courts, that they can't get it fixed themselves. And given that you are paying, I don't know why that's like that. I mean, it does go back to what we'd recommended in the BRR, and I think, Chair, we should stick. We should stick to that, because it would be better, I think, for something goes wrong in a court building, let the court officials be able to get it fixed. If Public Works were paying, then I can understand, but they're not paying. You're paying. So it. I don't know if you. I can see the COO is. Sort of, well, I don't know, okay, let me know. Okay, some of the people are sort of nodding in agreement. I don't know if the department would be in agreement, but if you're in agreement, should that not be something you try and act on?
Thank you, Chairperson. We should understand that Public Works is charged with the responsibility of repairs infrastructure. And in terms of the delegations to departments, I think it's up to 20,000 you can be responsible for day-to-day maintenance. So based on those delegations from Public Works, it's exercised within the department up to 20. Now we must also understand that above 20,000 rands, they follow their procurement process in that they've got approved service providers on their database. And services are being rendered, and the department then does a payment thereof to Public Works. I hope that clarifies the point. Thank you.
In addition, Chairperson, this is governed by a framework from Treasury. It's a document, the evolution of Public Works funding to departments or government departments. National departments need to adhere to the policy. Initially, this funding was Treasury, and then Treasury decided to move this money, sorry, for Public Works. There was a Treasury decision that this money must go to the votes of the respective department. I think the South African Police Service, SAFS, they've got total point or substantial control over their budget allocation, but because they've got the capacity, the technical staff, we don't have those staff to assist us. But definitely the NSF has substantial more control over the facilities management budget compared to other main departments.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have no question. I just have some advice. That every time when the department visit us, we would like some information about how many jobs you have actually created for that month or for that week, because the president promised South Africa that this year is a year of job creation. And in any democracy, when the head of state speaks, the departments should actually show that they are moving in that direction. That is one. The other one is about your relationship with Public Works and other departments. I just want to remind you that over and above the Public Finance Management Act, in your relationship with other departments or other spheres of government, you must also be compliant with the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act. Thank you.
Closer? May I? All right. DG, I take it you've dealt with all the questions. You've taken note of the valuable or invaluable advice. So mine is to say thank you to you and to the rest of your team. I'm given to understand you will still be with us tomorrow.
I have thought
we are receiving a presentation from the NPA, but Bunani says notwithstanding that you'll still also be here. It's not my decision. Yeah, you're the accounting officer. Okay. But thank you. I get the sense we should have allocated a day and a half to the department. So we'll look at that. We'll look at that in future. No, please don't. Yeah. Thanks very much. This has been good. We look forward to your responses to some of the issues we've raised and that you weren't able to address immediately, and that includes the scope of the report. We're adjourned.